Welcome back, everybody, to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I'm Jason Snell, your co-host, and across the internet from me, the man himself, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hello.
Hello, Jason. Welcome to Thursday.
It is. It is a Thursday. It's good to be here on a Thursday.
Oh, always.
And you're about to depart for parts known, I guess.
Parts too known. Familiarly known. You know, there was a time and a place where I loved the press tour. TCA.
How many years ago was that?
That seems... Well, I think it's been a number since I was like, woohoo! Yeah, so it's been a number. But I only go for a week now, so I guess that's tolerable.
Yeah, that's not bad. You've reduced the death march length. That's all you can... That's just, you know, just a death...
Yeah, it's like a stroll.
Yeah.
It's like a death stroll. A fun run. Yeah, and it's... I set up all my executive dinners and lunches ahead of time, and I'm good.
All right, that's good. Yeah. That's good. So it remains to be seen how we are going to do whatever we do on this thing next week.
That will be interesting. Yeah,
we'll try to find some way to do it. We'll catch a little time somewhere. Mm-hmm. Are you going to bring your microphone?
I guess I'm going to have to.
I mean, it's either that or I'm just going to have to call you and see if the switchboard will relay me to you.
Those were the good old days.
Mm.
Man, how you patched together some of those podcasts, I do not know.
Well, we'll figure something out. We'll figure something out. Right. A lot of news this week. I guess we should start with the fact that the Emmy nominations came out, because there's nothing better than giving awards for art. You and Dan Feinberg did a thing where you talked about the nominations. And you know, I feel like you have come a long way in your kind of like stages of grief with the Emmy Awards, just sort of acceptance. But I know that the content hole still needs to be filled. And so you and Dan got to do a one of your sort of back and forth exchanges about what got nominated and what didn't, and what was interesting about it. Just trying to step away from the whole, this is an outrage, and more like, you know, just analyzing what the choices were and which ones seemed surprising. Any overview, any big ones that we can, I mean, I'll put the link in the show notes as always, but things that really stood out for you at the Emmy nominations this year?
Yeah, I mean the nominations for Schitt's Creek were really surprising. In some way dubious, not because they didn't deserve it. I mean, a lot of people liked that show. But as I said in my thing, I said that just does not happen organically. Sorry. I mean, it doesn't. There's something went drastically wrong there. Like shows that have been on for that length of time. And I know that it got a burst on Netflix, which says a lot about, if that's true, it says a lot about the TV Academy voters not paying attention to things they've been sent and then only watching them on Netflix.
Totally, totally true. I've heard a lot of people talk it up, but I agree. I think it's really happened primarily since it hit Netflix.
Yeah. So, but even that is not enough to generate like an obscure show on an obscure channel all the way into major category awards. That's all I'm saying. I'll just leave it at that.
All right.
And then, so that was a big one. The other thing that trending wise, which I think bears watching, especially because, you know, I keep saying, let's get 10 nominations in each category every year, is that this year was the first time, I think in a long time, that we've seen, it wasn't rubber stamping, but it was, oh, we like this show so much, we're going to give it all the nominations, like for every category. So you saw over saturation of, and it wasn't just Game of Thrones with 32 nominations and tons of actor nominations. It was, you know, you saw it in Fleabag, you saw it in a bunch of different, less so in Veep, surprisingly, but you saw a lot of these shows come in that are really popular, and they kind of, you know, flooded the market with, their supporting actors,
right,
actress categories, which is interesting. I think that that's good. But this was the first time when you could see like a sort of like snapshot of, oh, OK, if this happens in the future, then they really need to do 10, because this isn't rubber stamping, but it's lazy. So people are like, I liked her performance and his performance. And because I only watch, you know, of the hundreds and hundreds of shows, I've watched these amounts and I loved, you know, Barry so much and Game of Thrones so much that like, I just, all these actors are familiar. I vote for them. And there has to be a way to not let that happen, because then it becomes, not only do we, is our voting body not doing their job in getting the breadth or the depth or everything, but definitely the breadth of the offerings. They are now being lazy. They've got 15 shows maybe that they watched. They fell in love with a bunch of these performances and they just like check the box. And you get, I'm not saying these people are undeserving of it, but if you look from a TV critic's perspective, or even a someone like you who watches a lot of stuff, you can just say, oh my God, you guys, you've left so many people out. And it's great that you rewarded all these other actors, but wow, the funnel has really, really shortened up.
Right. Yeah. Like I watch Game of Thrones, so I'm going to nominate 4 different actors and actresses in these different categories. And it becomes compressed where it's like it's as if there are only 15 shows on TV.
And the interesting thing about I'm sure you saw this, or maybe you didn't, and it'll be your revelations and people who did not hear that. Not only did all those, I mean, even HBO was like, we have so many, we can't nominate everybody. And they, 3 of their own actors were self-nominated and they got nominations.
Yes.
So it tells you something, like where HBO is like, look, we can't be greedy. These are the ones that are more likely to get the nominations. That's how every channel sort of goes about their selection process. Who's most likely to get it, not just deserving, because it's in some way deserving. It's like, who's most likely to win for us? And they had a lot of people to choose from. And they finally just, I think they just literally thought they'll never vote for all these people. And they didn't let some people in. So they self-nominated and they got in, which goes back to my point where laziness now is just like flooding the categories.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, you know, and I hate to say this because it's not that those the actresses in Game of Thrones aren't worthy. Like Gwendolyn Christie nominating herself and getting a nomination is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, if they're not going to make the categories bigger, you know, the alternative is that they're going to make a rule that says that only a certain number of people can be nominated on a particular show, in which case they would, you know, and maybe they will. Maybe they'll say the 2, you know, the 2 in a category is the maximum, and anybody else who got nominations below the top 2 is just going to be discarded.
Yeah.
That would be not cool for somebody like Gwendolyn Christie, who, you know, let's assume that she was not in the top 2, but she was in the top 5. But the Emmys could totally do that and say, you know, you only can get the maximum a show can have in a category is 2. And that would at least have more, you know, variety in those categories. I don't know.
Yeah. So there's something broken about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It is also, you know, obviously, you know, no Counterpart, no Patriot, not surprising. Why?
Sure.
Why not? But you got Succession in there.
Yes, Succession got in there. They missed. I mean, I was happy about that. But again, it surprised me that there were no acting categories left for that great cast. Other surprises I thought were, you know, Julia Roberts wasn't nominated. Neither was Sam Esmail for Homecoming.
Right.
I think the THR did a really good piece about how, you know, when movie stars used to come over and do television, they were kind of slam dunk Emmy nominees, and they're not anymore. And George Clooney didn't make it. And there's a number of pretty famous, quote unquote, film actors and actresses who came over and were ignored.
Right. Yeah. Because that looked like Emmy bait, right? That there used to be, you'd do a TV movie or a miniseries so you could get your, you know, rake in your award, rake in all the TV plaudits because you're a movie star who decided to come over and do TV. And that seems to maybe it's not working so well these days.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's good because it's like they're not going to rubber stamp things. But I don't know. I feel like every year the Emmys find themselves in this position where they are like they're in a grass field and little fires are popping up and they're just stamping their feet all over trying to put them out when it could have just been easier to, you know, earlier in the year, they could have done something to sort of, you know, sort of clear the field of all that dry grass and make some rules that help them out, you know. And again, I don't know why they don't do the 10 nominees per category, because now you have a thing where Pamela Adlon is like missing, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like, and Better Things is not in there. So, and you know, Dan said that I don't really look that hard into who did what on their nominations, but that he did a thing where he's like, oh God, like Sex Education was actually told by the Emmys that they were a drama rather than a comedy. So they got killed. You know, I mean, yeah. They're going to get killed, and they didn't get any of their actors nominated. They would have in probably a comedy situation. But again, they just shooting themselves in the foot, you know, and then these things will happen. I'm sure they didn't think like, oh, our voters will just, you know, flood it with same show nominees. But that's what happened.
And TCA, I like, does this where you guys have an actor category. And not an actress category and all that. And I like breaking down those things. The comedy drama distinction in the Emmys drives me bananas. Not only, so you mentioned Sex Education being considered a drama, which is not what I would call it ever. No. Russian Doll got a lot of comedy nominations, which is funny because I don't think of it as a comedy.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, just like Sex Education is dramatic. But fundamentally, I mean, I look at Russian Doll and I say, is that because the episodes were short? You think it's a comedy? Because it was, you know, it was a lot of things, but I would have called it. I mean, it's a sci-fi fantasy adventure, you know, mind bending kind of thing. But in the end, I don't think I would just calling it a comedy. It struck me right out of the gate. Like, really? That's the slot for that show? Because that's not where I put that show at all. But it is a half hour, more or less. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's that simple. I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. And that's one of those things that I'm not sure there's any way to... I mean, so many things are comedically dramatic or dramatically comedic at this point that I'm not sure it makes any sense. But...
Well, they could... I mean, if in their refusal... And they won't do this because it like shakes up the history of the nominations. But if in their stupid refusal not to go 10 per category... if they decided not to do that, they could always just add a dramedy category. There's clearly a bunch of these fit in a dramedy category, and they would basically recuse themselves from a straight drama or a straight comedy. You know, you can't like I'm just going to pick one. I mean, Better Things is definitely a dramedy, but like, you know, back in the day you couldn't. I mean, how is like The Good Place? You know, how does like The Good Place go measure up against Russian Doll? I mean, they're just totally different. They're different things.
Yeah, exactly. And right.
So it's like you tune into them for different reasons. I tuned into Russian Doll because it was dramatic and interesting. And it had a, you know, like you said, like there's
it's paranormal. A puzzle.
Yeah, it's a puzzle.
Yeah.
And there's not a whole lot of laughs, even though it can be funny. It's pretty dark, and it is about death, and so there's all this stuff. But that's not why I choose tune into The Good Life, which is also in many ways about death, but it's funny, consistently funny. They're just totally different shows.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas there's lots of wacky, wacky, wacky stuff in Sex Education. So
yeah, you could, you know, I mean, if you don't want to add another category, then expand the existing categories.
Sure, and give it more room to grow. Well, you know, it's awards about art. It's not ever going to be something that. I mean, what can you do? But anything else strike your fancy or your infamy, or it's just like, you know, you do you shrug and move on? I was happy to see a lot of Chernobyl in there. I was happy to see a very English Scandal in there.
Mm-hmm. Those were all good. I there are positives. I think that it's funny that I do have kind of a sense of, well, you know, you can't expect everything. And I said that they don't have a completely terrible track record. I mean, they took care of the Americans. They've done their part. The Emmys, they're just not consistent. And so, at some point, if you're just nitpicking their inconsistency, it just feels tiring. But I mean, obviously, you and I have been doing this for a long time. There have been years where it's just been like, oh my God, they totally botched everything.
Right.
And you know, that's your history chases you down in some ways, so that these things become like, oh, they did it again. But it's fine. I think there's so much stuff now that it's hard to even imagine people getting too upset about it because a show doesn't get noticed or an actor doesn't get noticed, because it's just, again, the breadth is so great Again, I just wish that they would make it easier on everybody and give more opportunities. 3 or 4 more slots, baby. That will help a lot.
Yep. There's a new story I wanted to mention, which is Netflix did its quarterly earnings report and showed rapidly declining growth. They added just 2.7 million paid members in the last 3 months, in April to June, which was their reporting quarter. They had projected 5 million during the period. The stock went down. They said it occurred across all regions, but it was a little bit more where their price hike came into effect. And I just want to mention this because I do think it's interesting. You know, Netflix game is spending a lot of money and driving subscriber growth. And I'm not saying that this is going to happen just yet. This could just be a one quarter hiccup, but the competition is going to be coming on strong soon. And I try to imagine a world where Netflix starts to think that they are no longer in, you know, massive growth and what that means. And would they spend less money? What they've been going with very little competition and they're soon going to have a whole lot of it. I don't know. It's just funny. We take Netflix for granted because it is number one. It is huge. But this is a little suggestion that maybe Netflix is not as dominant and does not have quite as massive a position as we might have assumed.
Yeah, I think that it is definitely troubling that it comes. I mean, they have what they say are reasons why people didn't, subscribe or add, and that there were losses, and that's why the numbers look so bad. They're saying, they did have a price increase. For the first time, I thought it was really interesting when Netflix talked about we didn't have a whole lot of super compelling new series in that window. And I was dumbfounded by that. I was like, huh, really? Is that what drives it? I don't think that that's what drives it. That's, they've never said that that was a thing that drove subscribers, they just added some because they don't do press that way. A lot of times they have, for example, there's a new series coming up on, I think it starts on the 26th, and they have blocked, they're one of the few people that aggressive outlets that aggressively embargo reviews, and they have the review embargo till the 22nd. So we would have ran it on Friday. Tomorrow we're not going to be able to do that until Tuesday. And then it comes out on the following Thursday or Friday. But so I don't think the model has ever been hey guys, we're going to come up with this series that's coming to Netflix that you're going to be excited about. It's usually they just drop it and then you discover it, like Stranger Things. And so I don't know if, when they say, oh, we didn't have a lot of compelling shows in that period, that's not how they really work. So it makes me wonder if they're, and there was some suggestions that they might in the future be more transparent about numbers. I thought that was kind of interesting. So maybe we're seeing Netflix slightly in flux a little bit about what their approach is. But there's no doubt that the takeaway is these lowered estimates and subscriber base and losing subscriber base, not adding as much as they could, is troubling in the fact that its biggest competition has yet to arrive.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think I saw somebody who I think is fairly bearish on Netflix from an investment standpoint, at least, who was saying, imagine having these shortfalls. You're spending all this money to generate all this content to acquire new subscribers, and the whole idea is you want the big subscriber base before the competition hits, and you instead have a shortfall, and the competition is coming for you hard, starting this fall and then continuing to roll out through next year. Major players spending a lot of money to catch you. Not saying that they're going to fall apart. They're not. They have this huge position. But yeah, isn't that interesting? Maybe Netflix is more vulnerable than we thought. And that's just, I'm excited as somebody who likes watching this. I think that's really going to be fun to watch. Just it makes it that much more competition instead of it being sort of the fight to see who can, take Netflix's table scraps. Maybe it's going to be more serious than that sooner than we might expect. And that's fun. That's great.
Yeah, no, it's fun for us.
Fun for us.
It's probably not fun for Netflix.
No,
but yeah, it's just like I just you got to think that Disney's like, oh, we're coming, because you're coming in at $6.99. It's crazy. Everybody's going to get that.
Yep.
And here's the thing, like, we are not in a bubble, but like, in some ways, like when they did their price increase, I thought, you know, for the bulk of people, given the value of what Netflix is, it has been under, it's been like, as far as the cost of it, has been sort of undervalued. I would pay more for Netflix based on what they offer. It's kind of astonishing what you get for the bang for your buck. So I didn't think that there was going to be a significant number of people. I mean, economically, people are in different categories, no doubt about that. But I didn't think there was going to be a significant number of people who would either not buy it or drop off because it was $2 higher. But if that is the case and that's the trend going forward, imagine what's going to happen when people can get something for $6 cheaper and it's all this Disney content. That could really shake up, like, not just like a decrease in projected subscriber growth, but a huge increase in subscriber loss, like completely getting out.
I have a couple other streaming related stories here. One, this is a Hollywood Reporter story headlined, "After Friends in the Office Mega Deals, Stars Want Their Slice of Streaming Money." Now, this is mostly about like residuals versus points and, you know, different ways that people get compensated over time for the thing that they create. So you create a TV show or you're the star of a TV show, and then it makes 10 years after it's off the air, 20 years after it's off the air, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent licensing it to a streaming service. Who gets that money? And it's not just the studio. It's also all the people who have points, including the creators. So this is why Jerry Seinfeld is insanely rich, for example, is that that Seinfeld money, you know, he gets performer and creator money out of that. And so the reason I bring this up is that there was a story last week about the Friends deal for WarnerMedia and the Office deal for NBC Universal to take those away from Netflix. And what this story says, which I think is really interesting, is they are these studios and streaming services are really wary about being accused of lowballing the price. So that example is like, you know, a show gets sold to Hulu back in the day from Fox or something like that, and they own part of Hulu. And the argument is that that wasn't really a free market, that the price is artificial. Mm-hmm. And so what this story says is that they are trying to be diligent about saying, you know, Warner Media is going to put Friends up for auction and Netflix offers, you know, whatever, you know, $90 million a year, and Warner Media counters with $100 million a year. The reason that's important is, yes, Warner Media is literally taking money out of its wallet and then putting it in its other pocket, but it matters for the people who get the royalties, the back end points.
Yeah.
And otherwise there will be massive lawsuits where Greg Daniels will say, "You owe me for The Office." And the creators of Friends will say, "You owe us for Friends and for devaluing that." And I think that's just, when we hear about these deals, sometimes it seems weird when somebody writes a check to themselves. You're like, well, what does that mean? But they kind of have to do that. They kind of have to set what the fair market price for this product is, because they do need to compensate the stars and creators and whoever else has a piece of the back end, as they say, of these of these shows. And I think that's kind of fascinating, and we're going to see more of that. And now everybody is going to be much more diligent when they sign their contracts for the TV shows that they're starring in or developing, to make sure that more of that streaming money comes their way if their thing ends up being a huge hit. Because it is a way that, you know, if you happen to be sitting on the chair of some show that is incredibly valuable on streaming, you are just, the money is going to pour in for you.
Yeah, but you know, the model is changing though going forward. A lot of this, like, people eye popping, like, you know, stories of money. These are all on old linear deals that are now where they got all these points back in the day, and not many people did anyway. But creators did, but not a lot of the stars did. Once it all goes into basically streaming stuff. There's going to be less that you can get.
Yeah. And, I mean, this story says that Netflix and other streamers are doing this too. Netflix is just buying out the back end stuff up front. So basically, which is a great phrase that does not exist outside of the entertainment industry to buy out the back end up front.
Yeah.
But the idea there that, that Netflix, when Netflix is paying you, Netflix will pay you more up front for that show, but you don't get to, you know, you don't get more later. You just get what you get, or maybe you only get if it's wildly successful much later. But for Netflix, that's the example, is if Netflix gets it forever, there's no such thing as it being licensed elsewhere. And so they just pay you a lump sum basically for, you know, thank you for making this show, and then that's it, it's over.
So it's and it's, I don't know. I think we're going to end, and we're getting into the area where it's going to be, you get what you get and you don't get upset. But yeah, there's still like, there's a lot of money from the old familiar shows. People are like Friends and Seinfeld. That money's still going to be a thing. And there's still people who are powerful enough to make money on like streaming deals.
Sure.
Or even ones where you sell it to a company that like that, you know, that doesn't have its own streaming service. Sony or something like Sony makes it, and you know, you're the person and Sony's got you under contract, and they buy the show from you, and then suddenly they have to sell it to somebody. Well, it's a pretty big difference if they sell it to Epix or if they sell it to Netflix. And then also if they sell it, for example, if they sell it to FX and then, you know, it gets put on, you know, Disney, or if it gets put on Hulu later, there has to be some way to like, okay, you can't keep selling this down the line without giving me my share. But you really have to be a very powerful star to get those points.
Yeah. So it's probably something that's going to fade away as the streaming goes forward. But the idea there is if you're Netflix, you're paying. It's just like a movie studio financing a bunch of movies. You're paying to spread the risk around. And some of those movies are going to lose money. And it's not like the people who made those movies have to give their money back. You paid them. But you need to be able to a certain extent to benefit from the ones that are the winners. And if you're paying out a bunch of other people a lot of money for the winners and you're not taking money back for the losers, you're never going to make money in the business is sort of the argument there. And I see that for Netflix. Like Netflix is going to pay you a really good amount of money to do this job, but they get the upside. They get you know, they get to benefit if it's an enormous hit. They're the ones who get to benefit from that.
Who knew that we were going to have so much math?
I don't know. Let's talk about something slightly different from math. We're going to move from math to biology. AP Bio, which was an NBC sitcom for 2 years. It turned out it was low rated, but it actually had very good digital ratings where it would be watched later or streamed later. So it was one of NBC's more successful streaming series, but not successful as a network broadcast series. And it got canceled after its second season. By the way, I'm in the midst of watching the second season on Hulu. I binged the first season last month on Hulu, and I think it's actually pretty good. I think it's a pretty good show. I think if fans of something like Community, maybe, it's got a little bit of that vibe to it. It's got Glenn Howerton and Patton Oswalt, and it's set in high school, obviously, AP Bio. I like it. It's funny. And so this is a funny thing where NBC cancels it. And then like a month and a half later, after Patton Oswalt's out there trying to find a place for it and save this show and all of that. And it is produced by NBC Universal in association with Broadway Video, which is Lorne Michaels' company, which is an NBC Universal thing. Like, it's all a homegrown product. After all of this, you know, 2 months or whatever since it got canceled, they picked it up to bring it back for the forthcoming yet unnamed NBC Universal streaming service, which is very interesting. I told this story to my wife and she said, do they not talk to each other? Could they not have just made this decision before? Because the contracts have lapsed. So they actually have to do new deals for everybody involved, all the actors and everything. They have to make a new deal to do more episodes instead of just renewing the old deals. But I think she's got a good point, which is, did NBC Universal not look at this show and go, oh, you know what? We're going to do a streaming service. We need original material. This one does really well on streaming. We could do like a Mindy Project thing and then just sort of bring it over. And instead, they're sort of like, no, we're going to cancel it. And then somebody in some other building is like, oh, did you see that we canceled a show that we can now pick up? Obviously, the left hand and the right hand are not talking there. But it is an interesting... Here's another little wrinkle in this where you've got NBC and ABC, Disney and Warner and CBS, too, that they now have this kind of multidimensional plan in terms of like where shows can go. And I think this is not the first, and I think it's far from the last, where you're going to see stuff get shunted around to be like, fodder for our streaming service.
Yeah, and it's hilarious to me that they don't talk to each other, and that
right?
You know, your wife has picked up on that. Like, isn't that obvious?
Why did you cancel a show that you wanted?
Yeah, exactly.
NBC Universal, and the answer is, well, Bob canceled it, and Bob works over on this building, and Jane is over on that building, and she wants it, but like, come on, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Brutal.
Yeah, it's always fun to. This is why I always have fun writing about the industry. They always do stuff where you're like, really? That's kind of, and plus, it really opens your eyes to like the model, like where NBC says, okay, nobody watched this show, and it's no good for us. And like maybe it's because they were putting their ratings in either a 2-week period at max, or even if they decided to be generous and do the 1-month thing, trying to make some money on it. That they rate things differently, whereas you throw it on a streaming service, and I think this really says something about we're farther into the future than really any of the analysts think they are, because people are finding stuff on streaming service. They prefer to stream things, and so also with no expectations, maybe it does better on your streaming service, and people are like, we should keep that. The numbers are good, you know. Whereas NBC was like, no, there's no possible way we could keep that. I think we're in that gray area between a shifting from the old to the new, and stuff like this is going to happen.
Yeah, so because it was, according to this Hollywood Reporter article, it was the most digital skewing show of the 17-18 season and the second most of the 18-19 season, behind only Brooklyn Nine-Nine, because they brought that over from Fox, and it's also got a really good following. And it did, like, what they said is the pilot episode rated 0.8 in the demo, the whatever, the 18 to 34 demographic. 0.8 was the rating. Not good, right? But after 100 days of viewing, it was a 5.6.
Yeah, see?
So if I'm running a streaming service at NBC Universal, you know, you would think I'd be on that. But I guess whoever is making the decisions over at the network doesn't care or something. It's weird. But I do think the show is funny. And obviously it resonated with a very specific kind of audience. And I'll throw in there, they presumably are going to pick up, I don't know what their deal is with Hulu, but presumably they can pick up those two previous seasons of it as well. And then they've got some back catalog for this show, too. Yeah. And people discover it and word of mouth it, which is what I did. Is I had a friend who said, oh, have you seen AP Bio? And I was like, I remember seeing that was a show last year, but no.
Yeah, I've never even
watched
it.
It's like, well, it's on Hulu. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then I binged a whole season worth. So, you know, it's not bad. So we'll see more of that. But yeah, come on, NBC. What are you doing? Talk to each other.
Isn't that partly, I don't know if our listeners will have this same reaction. Isn't it partly like you were not around Time and Day? If you heard about AP Bio, I mean, there was some talk about it, and maybe it got pretty decent reviews, but you were probably not around Time and Day. You had other things that were more popular that you wanted to watch because you got a million other choices. And there's no way, I'm going to just speak for you, I don't think you're going to go to NBC.com and track down their single watch episode of AP Bio a couple of weeks after. And you got a clunky ad combo in there or whatever it is. You know, I just don't think you're going to do that. But if it sits around long enough and you can get to it later, you'll watch it.
Yep.
It's a streaming thing.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, Hollywood Reporter has updated their headline about the Netflix thing, which is kind of hilarious. It says Netflix loses $17 billion in value in one day.
Yeah. A couple of reviews we should talk about. You reviewed Pennyworth. Speaking of places that people can watch stuff, but that nobody knows about. I don't know where I was going with that, because it's Epix again. Epic, the people again. who bring you a Perpetual Grace Limited and Get Shorty. Mm-hmm.
And Get Shorty.
Now also they have Pennyworth, which is from the producers of Fox's Gotham, and it is young Batman butler Alfred and his kind of, what is it, like spy-ish kind of adventures, and you really liked it.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember two things when you hear, when you, because people who are not big genre fans, like, and I'm not, but people here like DC or Marvel, they're like, eh, they discount it for quality lots of times. Or they'll say, I never followed it, and they don't do that. Or they'll say, wait, it's from the people who did Gotham? That was kind of cheesy, and Fox, and who cares? But it's important to remember that the first two seasons of Gotham actually were really good. Visually stunning. Storytelling was really interesting. And that Bruno Heller, who's one of the creators, he did Rome on HBO.
Right. So,
and he's a smart guy. He and his one of his partners is Danny Cannon, who's the director who also wrote some of the episodes of Gotham. They're kind of into the whole Batman, like, they like the early Bob Kane stuff, and this is Bob Kane and Bill Finger's character. But the idea, this is what they did. They said, okay, we did a thing for Fox, which was basically the more of the cartoonish, you know, origin story of, you know, Jim Gordon.
Yeah.
That's kind of obscure in the first place. And then you're kind of handicapped because it's going to be like, it's kind of a Batman story, but it's when Batman's like a kid.
Yeah, it's Batman without Batman.
It's Batman without Batman. And it's kind of like, but you're kind of thinking like it's still Gotham City, but now you're Jim Gordon, the cop. And it's like, it's less than ideal. It's interesting, but it's less than ideal for massive viewership. Oh, they got 4 or 5 seasons out of it. But here in Pennyworth, the approach is like, okay, so it's not a cartoon. There's not going to be the Joker or any of that right now. It's going to be Alfred, who actually, the history of him, he was an SAS trained soldier. And he's a badass and he kicks ass.
I would say very definitely inspired by. I mean, maybe you can make a case for the Alfred in Gotham, but definitely it struck me right down to the accent as being inspired by Michael Caine in the Dark Knight movies, where, you know, he obviously just think Michael Caine and like, okay, well, when Michael Caine was young, was he not a badass? Why, yes, he was. Let's see that. And I give you Pennyworth. That seems to be the idea here.
Yes. And like, and it's really good. That's the thing. It's funny because Dan Feinberg, I just retweeted it out and he's like, hey, I watched the first episode and I was way better than I thought I was going to be. I think that's going to be the reaction for some people. You know, one of the things, and also the character they have, Jack Bannon, this actor is great. He was in The Imitation Game and Ripper Street, but he is, he's really good. He's in like his mid 20s, but he doesn't seem like a kid. He's got some gravitas and, does he really know how to channel, who are we talking here? The person we were just talking
Michael
about.
Caine?
I've lost it. Michael Caine. Yes. He's like, he can channel Michael Caine.
Yeah.
He's got the same Cockney accent and he's got a little bit of the same look. But what's really interesting and surprising about Pennyworth, and I know that it's like, if you've seen Gotham or if you don't like, you know, if you don't like cartoonish things, you might think, I'm not going to even bother with it. But here's the thing. It's actually a drama made for grownups, and it's beautifully shot. A lot of darks. But it's in a real city. It's in London, but they tweak it so that it's a little bit not Gotham-y, but it's like that looks like London, but it also looks a little comic weird. And they created so many really surprisingly good characters, and it was engaging from the moment I watched it, and I was just like, oh, I like this. It's really good.
All right, so I feel like we're gonna get working up to a column where you make the case for Epics, which is like, you know, in August or something after this premieres, because this premieres next week, that you can say, okay, there are three things you can watch on Epics now, three individual shows. Perhaps you should give it a try and add it to your Amazon channels or whatever, just for Get Shorty, Perpetual Grace Limited, and Pennyworth. Just give it a go. I have to say, because it used to be like Epics, nothing is on there, and I'm like, oh, there's three things I'm interested in that are on Epics now. Huh.
Yeah, it's getting there. It's really kind of interesting. Yeah. And I don't know what it is, like $5.99 a month for the app, but
yeah.
There you go.
So one more thing before we do the letters, which is Frankenstein's Monster's Monster Frankenstein, a special on Netflix that is sounds completely bizarre.
It is truly bizarre. It is. To me, most of the joy in watching it was that, oh my God, this is on TV, that this got made. It just tells you a lot about, like, Netflix is like, well, we don't have to have a lead in or a lead out. It doesn't have to make sense. There's not to be any other additional episodes. We just decided, yeah, that's kind of cool. Let's make it. And when you watch it, you will be blown away. I mean, some people are going to love it because it's so campy and weird and, you know, it's absurd. But, and they might like it, but it is only 30 minutes. It's 32 minutes, it says, but I think it runs about 28 minutes without, once you take the credits out. And I have to tell you, it's like one long sketch and it is so crazy over the top. And I said that like 97% of the people who watch Stranger Things and tune in because David Harbour created the show and he stars in it, they're going to be like, what the you know, because even I was doing that. I actually watched it and I was laughing because I not so much. I mean, there's some funny stuff in it, but I was laughing because I was like, how in the world did this get made? And what will the reaction be from Stranger Things fans who say, oh, let's go see what Hopper's doing in this thing. And then they're going to be like, Mom, this doesn't make any sense. My brain hurts. Mm. You know, I don't understand any part of this. It's like, so it's like conceptually, it's almost like, you know, it's like a performance that if you're not open to sort of like, oh my God, this is absurd, you will just literally be standing at the screen like, I don't even know what this is. So in a lot of ways, that's the reaction most people will get. But I was just excited because that it's on is kind of like cool. That we live in a world where you can make this. And, you know, there's a little bit of Monty Python to it. There's a little bit of the Fast Show. There's a lot of, you know, nothing really makes sense. And you have to, if you don't understand that going in, I mean, look at the title, right? For God's sake. But like, you know, if you're not open to like anything happening, you won't like it. But yeah, the bigger picture though is I don't really think it's 30 minutes that, that people are going to say, oh my God, this is brilliant from beginning to end. It was this genius thing. No, it's just weird. So
all right.
There's your thing.
Check it out. Frankenstein's Monster's Monster Frankenstein.
Right.
Just because who is Frankenstein's monster? The Frankenstein's mm-hmm. monster. Who is Frankenstein's monster's monster? Well, Frankenstein is. They have a mutual monster thing going on. It's a good title.
Yes.
I can, that's how I can remember it. All right. We have letters. This is like a mega episode. What is going on with us today?
I know. What did we do?
I don't know. Okay. We have, or at least some letters, but we also have a sponsor. And so maybe this is a mega episode. Woo-hoo! Because of Mack Weldon. They are our sponsor. Mack Weldon, again.
Nice.
Premium men's essentials brand. Now, you're going to be trying some Mack Weldon stuff soon.
I am.
When you get a chance.
You told me that I've
sent
underpants.
You a little try-on for some underpants. I just mm-hmm. said it. There it is. Sorry, everybody. Yeah. Premium and Essentials brand, they say. Believes in smart design, premium fabric, simple shopping. I have so much Mack Weldon stuff. Comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, sweatpants. Their sweatpants are very good. They also have sweatshorts that are really nice. Better than whatever you're wearing now. They look good for working out, going to work, traveling, everyday life. They are so confident that you will love and be comfortable in what you buy that if for any reason you don't like your first pair of underwear, keep them. They'll refund you, no questions asked. But not only do Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good, they perform well. They have silver underwear, which is naturally antimicrobial, which means they do not smell. It's science, people. It's science. And I do love their sweatpants and their shorts so much. Wear them on airplanes a lot. Keep myself
nice.
Warm on those chilly, mm-hmm. chilly airplane flights. You can get 20% off your first order, folks. 20% by going to MackWeldon.com and using the promo code TVTM. That's MackWeldon.com. MackWeldon. Promo code TVTM for 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for supporting the TV Talk Machine.
Woo! Woo! Underpants,
love it.
Rule. Yes, I'm all about it.
Underpants. So we'll have an underpants report in a later episode, probably.
Yeah.
or some other kind of Mack Weldon report. It doesn't have to be underpants. They don't just make underpants. They make other things too. Okay, a few letters. We have many here. I'm going to have to kick some to next week, I think, because there's so many. But first, we got a tweet from our friend Matt Midovich at TV Line, who pointed out something that he said last week or 2 weeks ago, maybe, in the realm of HBO Max, because we talked about there's HBO Max now. It's officially the title of this Warner streaming service, and it's got the weird logo with the big Max with the gradient. And Matt just wants to put a chip down. He says, here's a hot take you'll only read here. This logo composition tells me the service will eventually, years down the road, just be called Max. Oh. All right, Matt. We'll watch that.
All right, Matt. Look at Matt. Like, getting over there with Matt. But here's the question for Matt. Will they fix the X?
Yeah.
That logo is so ugly.
Are they going to fix the weird gradient, like the X is dying?
Yeah, fix the X. It's terrible.
It's not good. Matt from the 330 wrote in to say, I bring you tidings of great joy. After years of not being able to play Prime videos on our Chromecast, other than screen mirroring, which is terrible, I was astonished to open the Prime app on my phone the other day and see the cast button pop up. Apparently this has happened recently, but I can find very little about it. Is there a secret love affair going on between the Google and Amazon families? Love to the corporate overlords who always make sure the customers get what they want. Matt from the 330. Matt, your answer is, I don't know about a love affair, but there was definitely a detente in the Cold War between Amazon and Google, and they agreed to support each other's stuff on their little video platforms and stuff. And that's why you can now use a Prime app to reach Chromecast, and I think you can use YouTube on a Fire TV stick and all of that stuff. They kind of kissed and made up.
Well, that's good.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it makes it easier for us, everybody.
It's nice. I'm going to skip a very long good letter from Steve. Steve, hold on. Next time. Scott in the 202. This is timely for this moon landing stuff. Just this morning, I listened to the latest TV Talk Machine. Yes, I listen on Mondays. Deal with it. And maybe stop all the Thursday or Friday banter, which is tedious to those of us who couldn't care less when you record or release it. It's just there every week. Well, fine, Scott. Fine.
Well, geez, tedious.
I just think it's absurd that we talk about recording days. It's intentionally absurd. I'm sorry it's tedious to you. But we've talked about it even more now because of your letter.
It's tedious monsters, tedious monster, tedious.
Yeah, exactly right.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. I heard you read an email from a listener recommending PBS's new Chasing the Moon 6-hour documentary series. I'd like to give another opinion. I own Apollo 13 on DVD and Blu-ray. I pre-ordered From the Earth to the Moon on Blu-ray the day I heard about it to replace the poorly made DVD set I also own and the VHS set I also still own. I saw the recent Apollo 11 film in a theater to get the big screen experience. I own multiple books by Jeffrey Kluger on various Apollo missions and more coffee table books of moon photos than anyone should. So I think my enthusiasm for the space program is a given. And after watching the first 2 hours of Chasing the Moon, I have to say they should have called it Inching Toward the Moon. It's slow. Very slow. PBS non-Ken Burns slow. Like it was edited in the 1960s slow. There's a lot of great information, especially after the first tedious, hour about satellites, but it's a real slog. Watch at your own risk. I'm not sure I'll make it through parts 2 and 3. That's Scott in the 202.
Wow. I have to say, Scott, first of all, I love that because there's a little unhinged part of anger underneath the subsurface there, deep down. I think you got to take him at his word. I mean, he seems like an expert on moon stuff. And if he says it's tedious, so, it's probably slow.
So here, I also own all of those things that he talks about owning. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to match Scott in my space fandom.
Okay.
I have watched the first two parts of this moon documentary of which he speaks. And what I will say is, I agree. I think the title is wrong. And I think that's one of the problems with it is that they decided to capitalize on the moon landing 50th anniversary to do a 6-hour long documentary about the space program. And as a result, you don't really even get to the moon landing until the third episode of the three. And as a 6-hour long space program documentary, I think it's actually pretty good. It is, if you want to skip to the good stuff, it is going to seem tedious because they want to walk you all the way through stuff. And if you are flooded with space documentaries and books and stuff, as Scott and I both are, you've heard it all before. Although there are a few things in there I had never seen before that I thought were pretty cool. But You know, they could, I feel like part three is the documentary that PBS probably wanted, which is just about like Apollo 11. And instead what this really is a six long, laboriously told documentary about the entire space program. Do you want to hear about Wernher von Braun, who was a Nazi and then was brought over to America to make rockets? And like, if you're like, what? No, that's not what I want to hear about. I just want to hear about Neil Armstrong. It's not the movie for you. Because gotcha. It goes through all of that. I think it's very well done, as long as you go in knowing it is going to be 6 hours about the entire U.S. space program, not just Apollo, not just Apollo 11. But I do think it's very well done, has some very good stuff in it. So I wouldn't call it tedious, but it's definitely, if you think you're getting Apollo 11, you're not for a very long time. That's absolutely true.
That reminds me, this is an amazingly, amazingly great segue.
Oh, you're Columboing me right now?
Less than 1% of the people will laugh at this. That sounds like the moon version of Snowfall, the FX series about the crack epidemic, which spent the first entire season not talking about the crack epidemic.
Or canceled after one season Hulu drama about people going, the first people to go to Mars, which ends the first season with them lifting off to go to Mars.
Yeah. Yeah. And they never got there because there was never a second
season. Okay, this is from Chris on Twitter. Emmy nominations came out along with a tradition of snubs and surprises lists from everywhere. They always seem odd to me. If your choice is picked, isn't someone else snubbed? What's your thought about the whole snubs, surprises commentary?
I think you don't know. I mean, I think that means like if someone gets it, someone else is clearly snubbed. I think there's more variation to that. I think that there's ones where there's a consensus, like at least a critical consensus, that they should have got it. And if they didn't get it, it's a snub. So that's my, my baseline.
Yeah. I mean, one person's snub is another person's justified choice.
Yeah. I mean, every year somebody says, oh, you forgot so-and-so on your list of snubs. I'm like, nope.
Yeah. Amazing how that works. It was clearly just an oversight. It was not an oversight. Mm-hmm. This is from Jesse from the 415, but in the 503. Glad to hear you'll be in Portland more, Tim. Maybe we can organize a TVTM North meetup. Huh? Well, we've done so well with a Bay Area meetup. But Tim and I are going to be spending a lot more time in Oregon. So
we are.
You never know. You never know.
What if we move it all to Oregon?
Jesse says, I mean, I know the probability is low, but it wouldn't surprise me. Good one. There might be dozens of us here. Anyway, in the Willamette Week published, Portland publication published this article about a new book coming out where Bill Walton solves murders in his downtime. I can't wait for the TV show. And really, the only question is, who would you cast in the role? And Jesse sent on a link to a new book, the first in the series of Bill Walton mysteries. Not making this up, a real thing. And I think I would say only Bill Walton can play himself.
Only Bill Walton can do it, unless you want to have the much, much shorter Joe Garofoli.
Yeah, that's true. He would be able to, only if it was like an audio book. Not if it's a TV show.
Like, he's pretty small for
maybe Luke Walton could play Bill Walton, younger Bill Walton.
Oh yeah, that could be. Yeah, although he got a job. He's pretty quickly after he lost the Lakers job.
Luke Walton did get a job. Luke Walton lost his old job, but Luke Walton got a new job. I like to say his name because that's what Bill Walton does. He just keeps calling him Luke Walton.
I know
he's your son, Bill.
I love that there is a Bill Walton mystery. That's more obscure than my Snowfall reference. That is just like, oh, what are you doing?
Murder is never the answer. Meanwhile, I suppose you're all wondering why I called you here, because one of you brutally murdered this man.
Meanwhile, somewhere in Australia or in Blighty, people are like, I don't know
who that is.
About.
No, well,
this reference to
all I can tell you is it's Thursday. Mm-hmm. Take that. See, I brought it up, Scott. All right, one more. Here it is. It's Dave in the 513 who says, how are you now? That's a Letterkenny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tim mentioned he'd be going to the Death March with Cocktails shortly. Does Tim have a preferred cocktail at the Death March with Cocktails, or does it change over the course of 3 weeks? I imagine day one, Tim is like 007 ordering a shaken Bombay Sapphire Martini, and by day 20, he's like George Thorogood ordering one bourbon, one scotch, and one beer. Dave from the 513.
Nice George Thorogood reference. in there. No, I have, well, back in the day when I did the whole tour and it was a death march, wine was my preferred drink. But what I found was, here we are in our little spirits section of the podcast. You would be at a party. There's a party every night, literally every night. You'd be at a party. And if you weren't like watching it, some of these like eager people who were hired to fill your glass would just keep refilling it. It would be the endless glass of wine, which of course had very big ramifications at the end of the night. So I, at some point I had to, at a couple of tours, I switched over to the margarita tour because I, that's the only hard alcohol I drink. And it was, I could just have it in my hand and I could sip it and handle that. But I'm kind of a wine guy. But now I'm only there for 7 days. So yeah, in fact, I've turned the tour into like, where in Los Angeles, I have like three places to go, but they're not, none of them are near the Beverly Hilton. Where can I find natural wine? And I was actually even in a wine shop and I asked them if they had any natural wine and they looked at me like I had asked them something in Latin. And then 5 minutes later, I found something on their shelf and I said, for the record, this is a natural. This wine is natural. So make a note.
What is a natural wine? What does that mean?
Oh, natural wine means that you're not putting any, there's no additives in it. You can still, I mean, it's debatable. You don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but you can still, sulfur is the one thing that's allowed in it. But there's debate, like how much sulfur, do you put it on your crops first or do you only put it in the bottle to keep it alive? But there's a lot of things that are not used. Basically, the natural wine movement, of which I am a huge fan and have been for many years now, is you just don't tamper with it. You don't put anything artificial in it, like no fake enzymes. Ah. You don't try to make the wine taste the same way it tasted the year before, because that's not how it works. It's a living thing, and it's controlled by the weather and the environment. But yeah, there's a whole huge thing, and in Los Angeles, it's starting to come alive a little bit, but it's very strong in the Bay Area, and by the way, very strong in Portland and France. Huh.
I hope Scott didn't think all that wine talk was tedious.
I know. He's like, dude, it's brutal. What an so much
on
wine.
A Thursday.
What
oh.
are you doing?
Oh, well, I think that's it. So you're in LA next week. So we're just gonna have to try
just
to find
a week.
Find a time. We'll pop in there. You know, read an ad, answer a couple letters, get your brief, and we'll find a way to do that. But you can send in your letters, TVTM at TVTM on Twitter to get to us. We're podcast at TVTalkMachine.com. That also gets to us. We also have a Facebook page that we don't check. Although I did post something in there today saying we love all of you. We just hate Facebook.
Yeah.
So.
That's interesting. Yeah. Might have just, to kill that page.
Just to remind them that we exist and they need to find us somewhere else. Anyway, I think that's it for now. Good, Tim, good luck on your trip to LA.
Thank you. And I will check in from hell.
All right. But until then, goodbye,
bye, everybody.